This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
So our next speaker is Dr. Ryo Hirose. We are really very proud of what he has done. The organ allocation policy is changing rapidly the last a couple of years, and Dr. Hirose is the chair of the Liver Intestinal Committee for UNOS, and certainly some of the changes are not necessarily very popular, and it generates a lot of tension, arguments, debate, but we're finally seeing things happening, and that really to credit all, Ryo has been instrumental in facilitating these changes, and we were joking about trying to put up some money to buy Ryo a bulletproof vest when he goes to these meetings. So, Ryo.
Thank you. I'm just going to put my presentation up here. When I give a talk in California, I leave the bulletproof vest at home because in California and New York, it turns out that the things that we're trying to get accomplished in the Liver Intestinal Committee really ring true to those folks that have such a tough time getting organs for their recipients. In places where what's new in liver allocation, when I go and speak in national forums, there's a lot of emotion, there's a lot of angst as to what these new policies may actually bring to other places in the country who enjoy a much better access to livers in this country. And of course, when you're trying to take something away from someone who has something, it's not particularly easy. I try to remain above the fray and talk about how many lives, American lives in general, that we're trying to save, not whether we're trying to save a California life or a life in New Orleans. But it's a challenge, nonetheless. So that's the background in which I'm going to talk about what's new in liver allocation. I'll try to touch briefly on things that we've already improved, such as the HTC allocation policy, and then talk about what's coming down the pike, including new medical eligibility criteria that we're going to impose upon folks that want a liver kidney transplant. So hopefully I'll get to all that. It's actually a fair amount of material. I'll try to go through it pretty quickly. Just a few notes on the history. In 1984, UNOS was established under NOTA, which established the OPTN, which is basically the organization that maintains the list of candidates, matches them to organs. And the task, the mandate, was to assist OPOs in the nation distribution of equitable distribution of organs. And I'll emphasize that word. And the final rule was established to the operation of the OPTN by the Secretary of HHS, and we made several changes to allocation, including using the MELD score with sickest first. But there are multiple components of the final rule, and these principles, including achieving the best use of donated organs, which sickest first may or may not actually do, should be designed to avoid wasting organs, to avoid futile transplants, to promote patient access to transplant, to promote the efficient management of organ placement, and that organ placement shall not be based on candidate's place of residence or place of listing. I would say we've done an excellent job in general of trying to meet the first two, and we've done a terrible job in meeting the third one. In setting sickest first, we decided that the transplant centers were going to be able to decide who's too sick to transplant. Lung allocation score actually takes into account the balance between the mortality on the wait list and post-transplant survival. We don't actually use post-transplant survival as a measure of who should get the next transplant. The problem with those tools is it's actually pretty hard to, besides being at the bedside, to figure out who's too sick to transplant. Those that argued against the MELD system, those that argue against wider sharing, say we're going to have more patients dying after transplant. It turns out after we used MELD as our metric to distribute organs, post-transplant survival got better, not worse. So it turns out I think transplant centers actually can learn from their experience and actually figure out who's too sick to transplant. So this fear that we're going to have all these patients, sick patients dying right after their transplant is relatively unfounded. And that goes if you look at the centers that transplant at very high melons. Most of them do a pretty good job with how sick these patients are. Now, they cost more. They're more difficult to handle. But if you could get those patients transplanted quicker, actually the cost goes down significantly, which is one argument against the notion that wider sharing will cost the whole system a lot of money. Others feel like this is what we're doing. We're on the Titanic and just putting lives, and we're just rearranging the deck chairs. But I would argue that it's a little bit different. We're trying to throw the lifeboats at the folks that can't swim at all and leaving some of the stronger swimmers till later. Now, you may lose some of those stronger swimmers, but you're going to save the total number of lives. You're going to save more lives in general by going after the most dire victims first. So that's my argument for wider sharing. So the problem is that there's a big disconnect between the demand for organs and supply for organs geographically. And it is no accident of geography that certain areas of the country have many more donors and other areas of the country have many more people needing a transplant. And if you look at it, it's really based on eligible deaths, which is the supply metric in terms of donors. Others will have you believe it has to do with OPO performance and whether certain populations are more generous than others. That argument actually is specious compared to what the difference in geographic death is around the country. That's really determines how much the supply is in a certain area. The way that we've distributed organs, however, balances many issues, including utility, justice, and efficiency. And we are, in terms of redistributing organs, we're really thinking about fairness and justice. The way that the distribution system works right now is that the entire country is divided into 58 DSAs. And they're sort of random in size. Some are huge, like our DSA. It's 100,000 square miles for CTDN, whereas some are tiny in terms of areas. Some have huge populations. Some have smaller populations. But the problem with these 58 DSAs is that they separate out the areas of supply and demand. They don't include large areas. Even if you were to share regionally, however, which are, you know, these are the 11 UNOS regions. We're in UNOS region 5. But if you look at regions 3 and 11, they have a huge proportion of donors compared to the United States. And those in the Midwest also tout an extremely high organ donation rate for their population. But in truth, organ conversion and authorization rates range from about 60% to 75%, whereas death rates range a lot higher than that. Actually, they're often an order of magnitude different depending on the region of the country you talk about. Now, one of the main things that we changed in the recent years was a policy called Share 35. This was not designed to fix the inequities in the system. This was designed to help those folks that are the sickest gain more access to livers. So those folks that are in MELD 35 to 40 actually get exposed to the entire region of donors. And again, the regions were divided up by UNOS regions. We then went back to the local DSA for MELD 15 to 34. And then if you didn't have anyone in your local DSA with a MELD above 15, then it would go out to the regional region and then go out to the national folks too. And this was just simply an extension of the regional sharing for status 1. Regional sharing for status 1 decreased the mortality of the status 1 patients and expanded access to the livers for the sickest patients. And we basically showed the patients who have a MELD score above 35 essentially have the same mortality of the status 1 patients. So it made sense to gain access to those folks. And in general, it's accomplished its intended goals. More patients with MELD greater than 35 are getting transplanted. And so far, we haven't seen a decrease in outcomes, either in those patients or in overall. There's been no increase in discards, and the increase in transport time and cold ischemia time has been modest. However, it is associated with increased costs. There's a lot more flying out for organs, so the cost of transplantation has gone up. Again, there are some other problems that we've seen. There are problems with flying these organs all over the region, and sometimes you run into logistical problems when there's late declines and late reallocations of an organ that's been allocated for certain centers for a certain person, and they decline at the last minute. That's really resulted in some logistical problems. But in terms of what the results have been since Share 35 went in, if you look at across the regions, again, across the x-axis is a different regions in the United States. You see the kind of transplants we've been doing over the last year, and Region 5 is in the middle. These are the kinds of patients that are getting the transplants in terms of whether you're being transplanted under standard MELD versus exception MELDs. And you can see there's a huge variation across the country. In Region 9, where it's New York, only a third of patients are getting transplant under their lab MELD. The two-thirds are being done under exception. So when you try to push regional sharing or more wide sharing, people waffle. It's like, why would I want my liver from South Carolina to go to New York for an exception patient who may not be have the same mortality as my patient down in South Carolina? If you look across the board, this is what has happened to the median MELD score at transplant over time. And in red, because we are among the worst in terms of how high your MELD has to get a transplant, you can see back in 2006, the median MELD transplant was 27. Now it's 35. So a huge number of patients have to get above 35 just to get a transplant. Whereas if you look at, for example, regions 3 and 11, the South, many of our patients get referred to those centers down there, and they're transplanting a significant lower MELD score. In terms of what happened in terms of total transplants, after Share 35, the total number of transplants in the United States went up, actually, and you can think of reasons why the total number of transplants may have gone up, maybe increased competition among centers that didn't used to compete against each other, maybe increasing the willingness of other centers to take risks with their donors. But it did not fix disparity at all. In fact, it increased disparity because the 11 regions are not particularly well drawn to fix disparity. They weren't designed that way. They were designed sort of randomly. So going to full regional sharing using the existing 11 regions would not fix disparity. And if you look at how many organs transplanted, in some DSAs, the distance the organs traveled didn't go up, but in Region 5, you can see they went up significantly. And it's part of the reason is Region 5 is enormous. It goes from Northern California, includes Arizona and New Mexico. So when you share across this such a wide region, you're going to have increasing distances. Discard rates did not go down in general. Pre-Share 35, the discard rate was 10%. The discard rate post was 9.5%. So with the implementation of Share 35, we did see some needs that have been exposed and things that we need to deal with before we go to wider regional sharing. We also did see a lot of travel for just single MELD point differences between one area, that region and another. And we're not so sure it's worth the extra cost and ischemia time just for a single MELD point difference. So in the new system, we've devised a way to try to minimize that. So the final rule, again, I'll remind, says that neither place of residence or place of listing should be made your determinant of access to a transplant. But we all know that many folks that have the means and have the insurance coverage that will allow it go to different places in the country to try to get a transplant at a lower MELD score. Now, how do you measure disparity? This is one of the key arguments in our group is what's a valid measure? Is it variance in transplant rates? Is it organ offers? Is it waitlist mortality? Should we just look at the variance of MELD score transplant, which is a reasonable surrogate for supply and demand in an economic model because that, you know, the patients with the highest MELD is the highest bidder. They get the organs. And what about just looking at pure supply and demand numbers? What is the supply? Is it all deaths? Is it all donors? Is it potential donors? And how do you really measure accurately the demand? Is it just patients that are waitlisted or waitlisted patients above a certain MELD or just all patients with end-stage liver disease in that area? They may not have access to a transplant or have different waitlist criteria for the different centers. We argued back and forth as to what we should look at. But again, when you look at what the supply is and what's determined by, it becomes obvious what is actually what determines the supply of organs. This is just death rates by stroke, by geography. And if you notice the big purple stripe, that's called the stroke belt in the southeast. If you look at death due to firearms, this is an interesting political, I'm not gonna comment, but if you look at where the deaths due to firearms are, it correlates with, not necessarily causative, but it correlates with the strength of gun laws and how many there are in that state. So in terms of measuring disparity, you can look over the entire country, and you can look at these disparity metrics, and some of the metrics that you can look at are like transplant rates by MELD score. If in an analysis done in 2011, if you had a MELD score of 38 to 39, depending on where in the, on the country you're talking about, you either had an 18% chance of getting transplanted or an 86% chance of getting transplanted. Same thing about the likelihood of death when you're just waiting on the list. Some areas of the country, if you have a MELD score of 38, 39, you have a 14% chance of dying. Others, you have an 82% chance of dying. Now, John mentioned this waitlist outcomes tool, which is, I think, a very interesting thing. You go to SRTR and look under tools and use the liver calculator, put in your state, put it in the center, and blood type and what your MELD score is, and it'll tell you, based on the more recent data than the two graphs I showed you, and John showed you some of those metrics. But if you... just out of curiosity, I put in UCSF and Ochsner Clinic, where some of our patients go. Now, if you look at the chances of a patient at 30 days now, I think John was showing 90 days, your chance of getting a deceased donor transplant at UCSF is 59% versus 88% at Ochsner. But it turns out we probably know how to take care of these patients, because your chance of dying at Ochsner is at 12.5% as opposed to 3.2. So if you're sick, you probably want to stick around. And if you're that sick, you probably can't go off and fly down to Louisiana anyway. You're probably going to be intubated or on CVVHD in our ICU. And actually, that's a good place to be. Your chance of dying is 3.2%. On the other hand, if you have a lower MELD or a little lower MELD, your chance of deceased donor transplant, because obviously SHARE 35 didn't regionalize that distribution, your chance of being transplanted at UCSF, if you're 30 to 34 in 30 days, is 8.7%, whereas it's 84% down in Ochsner. And those numbers in the first column has to do with how many candidates are waiting it during that time. So if you look at how much bigger our demand is and how much lower our supply is, now you get a sense of why we want to sort of expand the borders in terms of both supply and demand. Because it turns out that these numbers, in a big way, are created by the boundaries that we've put around the supply and demand areas. So the alternatives have been designing different districts, and I think you've seen all the maps. I'm going to go to some of the maps that we are considering. These are very controversial maps. People are up in arms about these maps. But what happens if we just go to 11 regions and just share widely? Well, the disparity in the supply and demand ratio, which again, as in this slide, or these slides I've defined as eligible deaths, those are deaths defined as potential donors, over the number of waitlisted candidates in that area that have a MELD score above 15. You can see by region, if you went to regional sharing, this is what the disparity would remain. Whereas if you went to 8 regions, this is how they would vary. And if you went to 4 regions in the country, this is how the disparity would look like in terms of just the pure supply-to-demand ratio. And this is just done graphically. If you look at the current system of 58 deaths, you can see a lot of red and a lot of dark blue, which means there's a huge difference between the waitlist candidates versus the donors. And if you go to 11 UNOS regions versus 8 versus 4, the whole thing evens out. Again, there's many concerns that have been raised about our plans, increased cost, transport time, cold ischemia time. So what we thought about is now we're going to model how it would be if we had a local circle around each donor and gave those recipients around that circle a certain number of extra MELD points to keep that liver locally before the match run was done, and whether we would get rid of the disparity benefit and how much less we would have to travel. And the long and short of it is it still reduces the disparity a ton, even with these proximity circles that sort of reduce the flying time. So whether you're looking at 4, which is the green ones, or the pink ones, the variance in MELD score transplant goes down a huge amount compared to the current system. And same goes with transplant rates. The variance of transplant rates goes down with either system with a proximity circle. So in summary, MELD has largely fulfilled the sickest first. We still have huge amounts of geographic disparity, and that obviously policy change is extremely hard to implement, and there are many political forces. There's a lot of fear of transplant centers of reduced volumes. There have been concerns about disparate OPO performance, which turned out to be not a particularly cogent argument. And there certainly will be increased costs and increasing distances. The analysis, however, is that the pre-transplant costs will go down significantly and actually more than the increase in the transplant costs. So if we can somehow fix our reimbursement system so that the transplant centers would be credited by lowering the cost of taking care of these sick patients, the overall cost to the system actually should be down. And just to finish up, I just wanted to talk about two new policies that are being implemented in the pipeline. I'm not going to talk about meld sodium. I don't have time for that. But meld sodium will go into effect approximately January 2016. So the sodium level, if you have your patients have hyponatremia, those patients will get an advantage because clearly it does affect post-transplant. Pre-transplant mortality. We will have to update our sodiums accordingly. The new policy that is now in effect is called the six-month delay or CAP 34. These are policies that were, in my mind, sort of temporary fixes to fix what I've already talked about in past conferences, which is the notion that the HCC patients right now enjoy much more access to transplant than our patients without HCC. And CAP 34 was designed so that you didn't go above 35. None of our HCC patients have an urgency of transplant that matches patients with a lab meld above 35. So we are going to cap all those patients at 34. And in many places of the country where they were transplanting at 22, those patients would get transplant right away. And so we are putting a six-month delay in and awarding any exception points to those patients. It doesn't affect our region at all because our patients usually never get transplanted at 22 or 25. They always have to go up to 28. In other areas of the country where they were enjoying transplants at that low MELD score, they're going to have to wait. So there's going to be less of an advantage to go to those folks. The justification for that is if you look at the transplant rates by either whether you're HCC patient or non-HCC patient, the HCC patients had enjoyed a much greater access to transplant, and when we modeled what would happen with 3 months, 6 months, and 9 months delays, you can see the narrowing of the gap in transplant rates if you had a six-month delay. It also allows for a natural selection process by which patients that are likely to recur post-transplant are weeded out if they would advance during those six-month delay. So we think there's an advantage from both aspects of things. That does mean a few of your patients that have bad biology will probably drop off, but that's not necessarily a terrible thing. And in terms of what kind of deaths that we expect, these are the modelings. The expected HCC deaths actually did not go up a huge amount. They did go up incrementally, but didn't go up a huge amount with a six-month delay. And finally, what's in the works in terms of a simultaneous liver-kidney allocation policy is that there's many problems right now. There is no policy. You can just get listed for a liver-kidney. If the nephrologist and hepatologist says, we think we need a kidney, there is no national policy. There's very inconsistent allocation policies depending on the OPO. Some OPOs will never offer a kidney with the liver, even if you're offered the liver. And so those patients don't actually get a liver offer from Utah. If your patient's listed for liver kidney, the Utah OPO won't give you the kidney. So we're going to fix that as well. This is thought to be a problem, at least, which is the number of SLK transplants by year, and it's pretty much steadily gone up as we've changed our MELD score and MELD 35 allocation priority. And the goals of the proposal is threefold: to establish medical criteria. If you don't meet the medical criteria, you won't get a liver kidney transplant. To basically get in a safety net and to resolve inconsistencies and policy differences, organ allocation policies. So the first two policy elements, again, are the medical eligibility, and then if you get a liver alone and you have renal insufficiency post, you'll get you'll get priority on the kidney alone wait list if you had a liver alone transplant. So in terms of medical eligibility, it doesn't give you listing criteria. It gives you, you have to just get fit medical criteria to get the kidney and the liver from the same donor. And so the eligible criteria that we've been working on include whether you have chronic kidney disease, and it separates those patients out from those with sustained acute injury, whether it's HRS or ATN or some other acute kidney injury. For those that are chronic, they have to meet KDOQI chronic renal disease criteria and be certified by a transplant nephrologist that you have chronic renal insufficiency with a GFR that was registered at or below 35 cc's per minute. If you have a sustained acute kidney injury, meaning that you have 6 weeks of at least a GFR less than 25 or on dialysis. So if you have 6 weeks of either dialysis or GFR less than 25 or any combination of those six consecutive weeks going up to transplant, then you'd be eligible for an SLK. The only other patients would be SLK, simultaneous liver kidney candidates that have a either metabolic or other reason to require an SLK other than renal insufficiency. And there's not great data that supports who should get a liver versus liver kidney, but there's no question if you look at the two groups and you have renal insufficiency, you have a better survival if you get a kidney transplant. In terms of the safety net, if you end up in renal failure after your transplant, you certainly have a much lower survival. And in fact, you have a lower survival on the wait list waiting for a kidney if you've had a previous liver transplant than those kidney alone patients. So that's the justification of using a safety net to gain priority on the kidney waiting list if you have had a liver alone. And to do that, you have to, at day 60 post-liver transplant, show that you're either still on dialysis or have a GFR below 20, and then you would get priority on the list. This is a kidney sequence allocation list. You'd follow these sequences, so you'd be right behind kids, and you'd have a safety net patient, so you wouldn't have to accrue all those years like the kidney alone patients have to do. And this is the proposal that's out there. So we have a medical eligibility, we have safety net, we'll have allocation rules that require OPOs to give you a kidney with a liver if there's a regional offer for a liver kidney patient. So those are the three components of the new allocation system proposal that's out there for public comment. So we're working hard to fix several things, liver kidneys, tumor patients, and the disparity. And I've got 2 years left as the chair of the committee, so hopefully we'll get some of those accomplished. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for Dr. Hirose? Can I ask the first question?
Yeah.
So, you know, the principle behind the allocation for HCC, because they are given an unfair advantage.
Yes.
At the same time, it's not necessarily a bad thing for them to wait 6 months just to observe for biology.
Right.
That's also the question. If you wait too long, it's like
yeah.
beyond a year, which
right.
we frequently face with at UCSF, where do you find that balance? Because
yeah.
I think that at UCSF, these cancer patients still wait 12 to 18 months.
And so my proposal eventually will be, if the entire country agrees with it, is that I think assigning a fixed MELD score for any condition is actually a wrong way to go because of the differences in access to transplant. So I would like to not have this elevator where your MELD score goes up every 3 months a few points. I'd like to peg, once you've decided they deserve a transplant, they immediately get the median MELD score at transplant for that area. So our patients would just go to 30-something, for example, and a Louisiana patient would go to 25 and just stay there. And they wouldn't get any automatic up unless there's some compelling reason to do so. And I think this automatic elevator makes these folks that are really stable really get the highest urgency points, which is sort of backwards. I think to motivate folks to do transplants and not just cherry pick and wait for the best organs, I think they should just get a fixed score, and that should be based on your MELD score transplant in that area and not have this, you know, continuous escalator that keeps on going up. And I think it should be based on your MELD score transplant. I do think that right now there's no question that the MELD score that the tumor patients get is high compared to their mortality on the wait list. But the course of their disease is different from end-stage liver disease, and that the longer they wait, the higher the chances of their dropout off the list compared to those with just end-stage liver disease, which their mortality goes up and down based on what's going on with them at the time, whether it's SBP or some other decompensating event. So I think that the way we're doing it is sort of wrong for HCC patients. I think HCC patients should have access to transplant. It's just that their drop-off rate in general is way lower than our other patients. And so particularly for those with single well-treated lesions, which, again, may be an unpopular thing, but I'd like to exclude those patients until they recur, because those patients can wait years and years and have a less than 1% to 2% drop-off rate. We all love to transplant those patients. They're easy transplant patients, but they don't need transplants as urgently as your patients that have a lab melt of an equivalent level.
And, follow up on one other, issue. It's astounding that in some regions they transplant 2/3 of the patient with exception.
Yeah.
Correct. And so, this is not something that you would like to see across. How do you police that and implement changes?
Right. So the other project, which we're going forward, is actually to make a national liver review board. So right now, these review boards that approve exceptions are regionally based. So Region 9 has their review board. Region 5, we have ours. A proposal that's going to be coming out for public comment will be the creation of a national liver review board. So the entire country's worth of, and we're going to try to have consistent policies. Some regions give exception points for ascites, for hydrothorax, for GI bleed, for ischemic cholangiopathy after a DCD. Others don't. The policies of those folks outside of Milan, very different in the 11 regions. I want to make one consistent policy throughout the United States so that we actually do things consistently and not have these 11 different policies for all these conditions. So that's another small project.
Great. All right. Thank you so much, Rio. Oh, and the iPad.
Yeah.
Could you address transferring points and if it's going to be acceptable or it's going to be something that will be in a, will people be able to list in one area and then transfer their meld exception points to another area?
Well, in general, I think, yeah, the question is whether you will you be able to transfer your exception points as opposed to, obviously your lab melds travel with you when you go because your labs are your lab. But the question is whether your exception points should travel. And it all depends on how we fix the exception system. If the exception system will give you the meld score transplant for that particular DSA, that region, obviously that wouldn't travel with you. But I think the notion that, again, we have to set the exception points at the right level. I don't think we have that right now. So when we fix that, I don't think that it should be, if we're going to base it in at the median meld to transplant for that area, we're certainly not going to have the exception points travel.
I know, but the way it is now.
Right. Well, the way it is now, right now, you have to reapply for your RRB, and the RRB will decide what your exception point level will be. Right now, it's based on your regional review board. So if you go from Region 5 to Region 3, there's no guarantee that the Region 3 board will say, yeah, you deserve 34 points. I mean, that's an outrageous number of points for Region 3, so.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.